Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Christoph Eschenbach. He conducts his final concerts as music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra in Philadelphia this coming week. Jason Pfeiffer takes us to the underworld of Eurydice by Sarah Rule at the Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia. An original score by Toby Twining was composed for the Wilma's production of the play. And Susan Lewis visits the Delaware Museum of Art, which uses art to both tell and inspire stories. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Christoph Eschenbach came to conducting from a successful international career as a concert pianist. He won numerous competitions, appeared with major orchestras, made recordings, and in 1965 was featured in a Philips LP set of the 100 Greatest Pianists of the 20th Century. In his late 20s, he began conducting lessons with George Snell and credits Herbert von Karajan as his mentor for nearly 25 years. In April of 1972, when he was 32 years old, he made his conducting debut in Hamburg with Bruckner's Third Symphony. He was named chief conductor and artistic director of the Tonhalle Orchestra in 1982, where he stayed through 1986. In 1988, he became music director of the Houston Symphony, where he stayed for 11 years, taking the orchestra on international tours, commissioning new works, and presenting opera productions. All the while, he remained active on both sides of the Atlantic, guest conducting and assuming leadership roles in various ensembles. He was named music director of the Ravinia Festival in 1994, and 4 years later assumed the post of chief conductor of the NDR Symphony Orchestra in Hamburg, Germany. In 2002, he took up the helm as music director of the Orchestra of Paris. In September 2003, Christoph Eschenbach became the seventh music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra, an ensemble he had conducted often and with whom he had also recorded. Over the course of his five seasons in Philadelphia, Maestro Eschenbach has championed both new music and new ways of making music, and has been constantly active in efforts to make classical music and the people who create and perform it more accessible to greater numbers of people. In October of 2006, Christoph Eschenbach announced he would step down as music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra at the end of the 07-08 season. He'll conduct his final concerts with the group as its leader in its home city over the next 2 weeks. Well, let's start at the beginning. You've been making music for a very, very long time. When did you first hear of or hear the Philadelphia Orchestra?
Well, when I was a boy of maybe 13 years, my parents bought the first records for me of the Philadelphia Orchestra, Tchaikovsky symphonies, and by the way, also a recording which I love, the Seasons of Vivaldi, conducted by Guido Cantelli, who died so early in a plane crash and was conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra. So these were my first encounters with the orchestra. And the real encounter was then when I played as a soloist under the direction of Claudio Abbado in the early 70s with the orchestra in the Academy of Music. And I never forget the sound of this orchestra when I heard it first live. And I remember there was a Brahms Symphony No. 4 on the program, and I just was overwhelmed by the string sound.
Fast forward 20-something years, and you hear that the Philadelphia Orchestra wants to talk to you about becoming its new music director. What was the first thought in your head?
Well, I was flattered, honored. And by that time, I knew the Philadelphia Orchestra better because from 89 on, I conducted it regularly until 96. I had another engagement in 98-99, but I had to cancel it because of illness. And then the search committee approached me in 2000 with a question if I would be interested. And of course, I was interested, highly interested. So the approach began and the conversations began and the contract was made then in 2001, which was a very significant date for me, of course.
You at this point were music director of more than one orchestra when you took on Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And you had experience of being music director of orchestras at this point in three continents. You had been in Japan, Europe, and in Houston. When you started to think about what you were going to do with the Philadelphia Orchestra, did you have an overall philosophy that was going to be different in Philadelphia to what you'd done otherwise?
Not really. I thought I do a continuation of all the experiences which I gathered in these other jobs in these other continents, which are very diverse, which were very diverse, and which I thought could enrich an orchestra and an orchestra organization and everything which is connected to an orchestra. So I went on with the collection of experiences I had and made a plan out of the results.
How much of that plan was about maintaining tradition and how much of it was about adding to that tradition?
Well, I mean, there is a motto in my life, actually. It derives from Gustav Mahler, who said, tradition is not preserving the ashes, but carrying on the torch of fire. And therefore, I surely was aware and am aware what great traditions the Philadelphia Orchestra has, and also to maintain this tradition, but build on it and go to newer shores. And I think I did some of that.
What was different about this orchestra, to say Houston? Because obviously you came to the Philadelphia Orchestra, one with an older and a more prolific reputation. Did that make it easier to make music, or did it make it more difficult?
I didn't ask that question, actually. I just made music, you know, the way I feel and the way I have to make music, or what an inner voice tells me, that is the right way to make music, otherwise I would be a fake. And so I embraced the orchestra, I embraced the phenomenal abilities in every field, and also in the field of new music, and nurtured it as every orchestra, also if on the highest level like this orchestra, has to be nurtured every day in a way. And so I did that, and I felt actually very comfortable with it.
Were there any surprises along the way as you developed this relationship? Was there anything that you hadn't expected?
Well, there are always surprises, but I don't want to go in detail. The surprises certainly were not coming from the orchestra itself.
Fast forward to 5 years now. As a conductor, the sound of the orchestra has changed in your hands. You'd agree?
Yeah, I think so.
Tell us how.
It's not the sound of the orchestra. And I'm a little bit against marking or putting a mark on an orchestra like this is the Philadelphia sound. Of course it exists, but it is not always the Philadelphia sound. Otherwise they couldn't play Mozart or they couldn't play Schoenberg. And the attitude has changed, I would say.
How so?
The musicians have no block anymore in front of them. They are not blocked. They have gained a certain freedom of music making, even physically. If you see the orchestra, they move with the music. They express the music so much that you can see it, not only hear it. And I find it a very, very important thing for audiences to participate in that and not to have a perfect machine on stage, but which is a little bit distant and a little bit seemingly not so human. And it was rather easy, I think, in this short time I was here, to bring that out of these people, because these are wonderful human beings, exceptional human beings, and very highly intelligent. So the connection between that brought out their humanity and melted it into the music making, which is very obviously human now.
The Philadelphia Orchestra has had only 7 music directors during its entire history, and there's almost a shorthand for what each of them accomplished. If in 50 years we talk about Christoph Eschenbach, what would you like to see, hear people say about your legacy as the 7th music director of the orchestra?
Well, probably that it was the shortest, maybe, but very compressed in quality, I would say. And also what we achieved was a lot. We recorded more recordings in these last 3 years than the orchestra ever has recorded in a short time. And that is certainly an achievement which takes into the future. And, well, it was a very, very concentrated 5 years. I mean, it was, every moment was filled with music. I did a lot of chamber music. I introduced, so to say, postlude concerts, where I participated also often as a pianist, and with orchestra musicians or with soloists together, and which were very much acclaimed by the audience, which brought also musicians and audience nearer to understand the musicians more, in hearing them solo playing, understand me more, hearing me piano playing and talking a few words. And all that hadn't happened before. I wish that it continues, of course, and that many other things are taking place here when I have left. Fortunately, we have plans that I return, and I wouldn't if I wouldn't feel such a close relationship to the orchestra.
Philadelphia Orchestra music director Christoph Eschenbach. He conducts the orchestra in its final performance of Mahler's 8th Symphony at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall this evening at 8. His final performance as music director in Philadelphia is on Saturday, May 17th, which WRTI will mark by dedicating our classical music programming that day to recordings made by Christoph Eschenbach, both as a pianist and as a conductor.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Art often tells some kind of story, but some art more directly connects with the narrative. In 1912, the work of American illustrator Howard Pyle became the nucleus of what is now the Delaware Art Museum. Since then, the museum has continued to build upon the theme of storytelling, even as its collection has spread it in different directions. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the continuing story of the museum itself.
On the lower level of the Delaware Art Museum, a child, or even an adult, can create an illustrated story on a computer screen, step by step. First, you pick a genre, comedy, for example. Then you choose from backgrounds which might look familiar to art students or anyone who's been wandering around the museum.
These are all settings from works in our collection.
Museum Director of Education Courtney Waring rattles off some of the possibilities.
We've got works by Howard Pyle, Edward Hopper, John Sloan, Frederick Edwin Church, and you select one.
In this computer game, the characters and even the props are also all images from the museum's collections. After making the visual selections, you can write a story, even with a strange cast of characters in a rather unusual setting, as in this sample story.
A friendly old hobo was eating his delicious baked beans when all of a sudden an armored knight seated atop a majestic horse and a cowboy on a bucking bronco stumbled their way onto the hobo's seat.
This is one of the ways the Delaware Art Museum brings its collection to life. And storytelling through art goes back to the beginning of the museum's own story. Once upon a time, actually in the early days of the 20th century, reading was on the rise, as technology had created more leisure time and electric light by which to read. Books and magazines were often illustrated with original paintings and graphic works. Wilmington native Howard Pyle was a leading illustrator and the first to actually teach illustration. Then, in 1911, Pyle died suddenly at the age of 58. His friends and students banded together to protect and preserve his works. They formed the Wilmington Society for the Fine Arts.
At that point, it was almost entirely his art.
Delaware Art Museum Executive Director Danielle Rice says the collection expanded.
It eventually grew to include the art of his students as well as a library full of illustrated books and archives, his students' notes, for example.
His students included Jesse Wilcox Smith, N.C. Wyeth, and Frank Schoonover, all who lived and worked in the Brandywine Valley. Although illustrations were in demand commercially, Delaware's curator of collections and exhibitions, Mary Hollihan, says they were not particularly valued as fine art.
Often the artists themselves really didn't go to any great lengths to preserve the work, or it was thrown out by the art editing department.
That, she says, is changing.
From the point of view of the general public and also scholarship. And I think as more illustration is seen, as can be seen here, more and more people will come to realize that it is as valid an art form as what we traditionally consider fine art.
But illustration was not to be the only focus of the museum. In the 1930s, as the country struggled to emerge from the Great Depression, the Wilmington Society of the Fine Arts found itself faced with a large gift and an even bigger challenge. The Bancroft family would donate the sizable Samuel Bancroft collection of pre-Raphaelite art, along with a large tract of land, but, says Danielle Rice, there was a condition.
The requirement was that we build a building. In fact, it was Frank Schoonover, an artist who had been a student of Howard Pyle, who was very instrumental in leading the charge to raise the money to build the building, which is the brick building with the arches that is still part of the museum complex.
The newly named Delaware Art Center opened in 1938 with an expanded focus. The 19th century pre-Raphaelite artists gave themselves that name because they were looking back in time before the great Renaissance master Raphael, says Mary Hollihan.
They were looking back really toward the late Middle Ages, both for their techniques and for their subject matter, and for what they saw really as their personal virtue, looking at almost a monastic type of morality.
The art, which includes paintings, drawings, prints, decorative arts like stained glass, furniture, and jewelry, also has a literary link.
A number of the pre-Raphaelite artists were illustrators themselves. They were interested in really literary art of all kinds, both ancient, biblical, poetry by Shelley, Tennyson, Keats, and literature of their own time. Dante Gabriel Rossetti did some paintings which were, you might say, actually illustrations of his own poetry.
As the years went by, the museum also increased its holdings of 19th and 20th century artists like Winslow Homer, Edward Hopper, and Andrew Wyeth. In the 1960s, the museum, says Rice, took another giant leap forward.
In 1960, the curator of the museum at the time was working on an exhibition, and he came to know the widow of one of these artists.
The artist, John Sloan, says Mary Hollihan, was known as one of the ashcan artists.
Sloan and his group originally got that moniker, so to speak, because they were painting works of art not in the refined academic tradition, you know, of genteel interiors, but they were out on the street actually painting what they were seeing there, which often at that time period was pretty grainy and gritty.
Sloan's widow, Helen Farr Sloan, became a dedicated supporter of the museum, even moving to Wilmington in her later years and donating over 3,000 paintings, prints, and drawings by her husband, giving the museum yet another distinctive strength. The museum has continued to grow inside and out, adding an education wing in 1959, an auditorium in 1987, and undergoing more renovation in 2003. As it's filled out its core collection of American art and illustration with 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st century art, a sculpture garden, and other works, it's taken community requests into consideration about art and even landscaping, says Danielle Rice.
I was approached by a group of women who expressed their interest in having a labyrinth in the museum sculpture garden. Labyrinth is a single circular path into the middle and then you walk out. And through absolute volunteer effort, the labyrinth came to be, and it's become one of the most popular places in the sculpture garden right now.
In the end, the Delaware Art Museum strives to inspire creativity in all ages and to be more than a place to just look at art. Last year, a contest challenged people to make up short audio stories prompted by objects in its collection. Now, labels identify those works of art about which the winning stories were made, and visitors can listen to them on iPods as part of the museum experience. Danielle Rice calls it a museum about stories, and the Delaware Art Museum's own story goes on, with a beautiful setting, passionate characters, and unexpected twists and turns that all seem connected in the end, or at least the end of this chapter.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Current special exhibitions at the Delaware Art Museum include paintings, sculptures, and drawings in The Baroque World of Fernando Botero, on display through June 9th. This Is War, a show of war-themed illustrations and posters, opens May 10th and runs through August 10th. The work of playwright Sarah Rule has been the subject of great acclaim in recent years. In 2006, she won a MacArthur Fellowship, also known as the Genius Grant, and her 2004 play, The Clean House, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Philadelphia's Wilma Theatre produced its version of The Clean House in 2004, and this week opens another Rule play, Eurydice. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the play reimagines an ancient story with a combination of abstract imagery and live music.
The play is based on the classic myth of Orpheus, said to be the father of songs. The story from Greek mythology goes that the wife of Orpheus, Eurydice, one day had a tragic misstep and died. Heart-stricken, Orpheus journeys to the land of the dead to retrieve her. With his beautiful, spellbinding music, Orpheus persuades the gatekeepers of the underworld to allow him to lead Eurydice out of Hades. But under one condition, he must walk in front of her and not look back until they exit the underworld. The Orpheus myth has been taken on by many different storytellers and artists over the years. Balanchine, Stravinsky, Tennessee Williams, and Philip Glass are some of the more recent ones. Wilma Theater Artistic Director Blanca Ziska says it's a tale that's revisited again and again because, first and foremost, it's an amazing love story.
And the potential of returning back from death, I think, is another subject that we long for, this idea of afterlife. You know, it's almost impossible for us to think that one day it will be over. So I think there are these two motifs right there that are in our minds and hearts that we deal with.
Within this story of lost love and life after death, the Eurydice play also delves into an exploration of the bond between a father and a daughter. When Eurydice goes to the underworld, she is reunited with her father, who had died some years earlier. The two rekindle their relationship so that when Orpheus comes for Eurydice in Hades, she's forced to choose whether to go with her husband or stay with her father. This part of Sarah Rule's storyline is different from other versions of the Orpheus myth, and it's notable that it focuses in on the perspective of Eurydice. Most adaptations center on Orpheus. But giving extra attention to the heroine's point of view isn't this work's only distinguishing feature. An abstract, surreal quality is illustrated by Sarah Rule's script notes, in which she writes, "The underworld should resemble the world of Alice in Wonderland more than it resembles Hades." From the opening scene of the Wilma Theater's production, this otherworldly feel is strong. With the exception of Orpheus, Eurydice, and a few large beach balls, they're supposed to be on a beach, the stage is eerily bare. There are no set pieces to speak of, only an old water pump and a narrow channel of water that runs across the stage. Blanca Ziska says that especially in a play like this, the set design plays an important role in establishing a tone.
I was from the very beginning very clear that I wanted to have something that is more like an installation art piece than a full set, so that it doesn't impose itself on the text, that it doesn't create anything that is heavy. I wanted to have the flexibility to create a sense of total openness for the first scene when you are on the beach and you are kind of capturing that unearned optimism of the young couple that is in their teens.
The visual world of the Wilma's Eurydice was conceived by Mimi Lian.
This is probably the most spare set that I've ever designed.
Lian says her vision for the design came from a simple image that came to mind as she first read the script, the part where Orpheus begins to lead Eurydice out of Hades.
I just felt like it was such a precarious journey for them. And I just pictured the two of them kind of walking on a tightrope very carefully, you know, one foot in front of the next, and one small misstep and like everything would be lost. So it was just like a line. And I felt so strongly about that that, you know, the rest of the design kind of came from that image.
In the view of Mimi Lian and Blanca Ziska, Eurydice is more of a poem, a series of images and emotions, than it is a conventional play with a linear plot line. Lian says the set is essentially a container for this imagery and emotion. In conjunction with the visual elements, the emotional climate of Eurydice is also undergirded by music. Composer Toby Twining, who specializes in choral music, was commissioned to write an original score for the Wilma's Eurydice. Nearly 2 years ago, Blanca Ziska heard one of his recordings on the radio and immediately felt his musical style would be a great fit for the play.
I thought the music will really help to create that essence of emotions that are necessary for the play and will add depth and beauty to the text.
The composition from Toby Twining is performed each show by a live quintet, four vocalists and a cellist. The music they perform to help create this sense of an alternate world is in many cases microtonal music. Toby Twining explains it uses intervals not found in the traditional Western system of composition, in which there are 12 equal intervals to the octave.
It's finding consonances that are closer together than adjacent keys on a piano. So you hear pitches that feel, you know, fresh and unusual and are hard to understand or identify, and yet it has a way that locks in and feels smooth, you know, similar to barbershop quartet music or Renaissance vocal music.
Twining says one of the more difficult aspects of writing a score for Eurydice was representing the music of Orpheus. Here is a legendary poet and musician. He's said to have charmed the trees and the beasts of the forest, moving even stones to tears with his songs.
You know, Elvis isn't the king. Orpheus is the king. And when Orpheus sings at the gates of the underworld to retrieve Eurydice, it just, you know, feels like it's supposed to be the greatest love song ever sung.
That's a lot to live up to. So a little technology came in handy with creating this striking musical moment.
We decided to use all 8 speakers that are positioned around the theater and record the quintet 7 times and then have an 8th quintet, you know, live, and so that we have basically 40 different parts going on at the same time.
Through this music and the set design that work in tandem with the lyrical poetry of the play, the underworld and regular world of Eurydice feel rather strange and distant. Yet simultaneously, there are recognizable elements of love lost, the bond between a father and a daughter, and intrigue about the afterlife. It's such themes that seem to be what make the Orpheus myth a tale that's so often revisited. Though in many ways it's perhaps abstract and surreal, Eurydice is ultimately a familiar story.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Sarah Rule's Eurydice is at the Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia through June 1st. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Catherine Blodgett, Lauren Saul, Dennis Lawson and Megan Wendell. You can now listen to past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, www.wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.